And the thing about medicine is it holds out such promise now that we've almost come to expect that we won't suffer and that we'll be incredibly healthy until we die peacefully in our sleep around 98 years of age, having been able to do everything we wanted to up until that point, which is just, I think it's a myth that's around in the ether because of how advanced medicine is, but it's inaccurate. You know, life is inherently full of suffering. You know, the noble truth number one, there is suffering. We have to acknowledge that and be with that and take the joy where we can.
Welcome back to Flourishing in Medicine, from Surviving to Thriving. I'm your host, Dr. Mick Krasner, and this podcast is produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier in New York State that's committed through multiple peer support offerings to supporting the physicians they protect. The title of today's podcast, Well-Being in Healthcare, a conversation with Dr. Maura Kenny, a psychiatrist with Southern Australian Health and a mindfulness teacher, trainer, and researcher with 20 years of experience teaching mindfulness courses in both clinical and organizational settings. Her special interest is the well-being and resilience of healthcare staff, and she's developed a 6-week mindfulness course that has been delivered for several years in South Africa's public health settings and in other healthcare and university settings around Australia, the United Kingdom, Singapore, and Taiwan. Maura is also the inaugural director of staff well-being at the largest healthcare network of over 17,000 employees in South Australia Health. In this dialogue today, Dr. Kenny traces her journey in medicine to psychiatry, driven by her fascination with biology and a desire to alleviate suffering. She discusses her introduction to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for recurrent depression by Professor Mark Williams from Oxford, which inspired her to integrate mindfulness into her psychiatric practice with notable success. This led her to develop mindfulness-based courses, adapting them for healthcare professionals, and to advocate for mindfulness teacher training standards. Dr. Kenny's current role is as Director of Staff Wellbeing in South Australia's healthcare system. She emphasizes the importance of tailored interventions to address the unique challenges faced by healthcare teams, addressing the culture of these organizations and teams while maintaining mindfulness as a centering tool for herself and for others who may find it helpful. She reflects on the significance of understanding different perspectives and fostering positive relationships and finding joy amidst the complexities within healthcare. And now my conversation with Dr. Maura Kenny. Welcome, Dr. Kenny, to Flourishing in Medicine, from Surviving to Thriving. And what I'd like to do, as I often do with the guests, is begin getting to know you a little bit. Mostly want to hear about why medicine? Why did you decide, out of all the things you could do, to become a physician? And I think these stories are really interesting in a lot of ways, and many of us have been influenced by early experiences, formative things in our childhood, but not entirely necessarily. It could be something that happened in your educational process or even as you began working in life that brought you to this. So it's, give us a little bit of that background story for yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect on this, and it's making me smile actually, because I actually was intending to become a domestic science teacher when I was at school. And why was that? Well, it was because I was actually good at the cooking part of the domestic science piece, not the embroidery stitching side. And then I was going to become dietitian because that seemed like an application that was more clinical. And then I looked into going to, you know, do a dietitian degree. And then I really enjoyed biology at school and was good at that. And I also always had a great love of reading. So I was reading a lot about what being a doctor was about, and was really quite inspired, I think, by the profession as the way it was portrayed in different novels. So decided I would do medicine. I know that my parents just kind of watched in a fairly bewildered way as I transitioned from one idea to the next over a couple of years. And they never pushed or pulled or really said very much. They just let me go with what I wanted to do. I spoke to the careers officer at school and she said, oh, you'll never get into medicine. It's far too hard. And, you know, that was a bit like a red rag to a bull to me. It's just like, no, I'll get the grades. I'll get in, which I did. So, yeah, and I don't think I was particularly clear about what specialty I would do at that stage. I just was interested in the application of biological sciences in particular to the human condition. And as I went through med school, the things that I found interested me most actually was mental health, which is why I ended up in psychiatry. I just thought those placements were so, so interesting. The people in them were so interesting. There was that lovely interplay between the art and the science and what the individual brings to the healing relationship, and really met some very inspiring role models through that time. So it just kept me kind of intellectually engaged, emotionally engaged, and I did an intern year and then went straight into psychiatry, which you could do back then. Now you have to do a couple of years of other things, but I did my intern year and then straight into psychiatry training. And here I am in quite a different place now after all those years. Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that different place, which is part of what I'd like to talk about. But let's just stay on this origin story just a little bit, because you said you were inspired by the narratives and the depictions of the physician in the novel or in whatever you were reading. What was it about that? What were the qualities that inspired you that you felt, that you identified with, that you felt like, gosh, that would really be me, that could be me, that might be me if I apply myself in a certain way?
There was something about the intellectual challenge of it, the need to study hard, which I liked doing back then. That was then applied to the difficulties that people have, patients have in their lives, illness, suffering, something about how you had to connect with the person before you could apply any of the knowledge. I'm not being very articulate here around this because I was so young. I mean, I started medicine when I was 17. So I was reading this stuff probably when I was 14 or 15 or something. So I look back at it now and I think, wow, so young, so naive. I had so little idea really about what the world of medicine would be like. And of course, it was only after my intern year that, you know, we started reading books like Bleeders Come First and House of God, which were not the kind of books that would have inspired me to start medicine at all. Fortunately, I'd already graduated by the time I came to those books and was on the medical trajectory. So it is kind of fascinating, isn't it, about how literature and film can really inform our ways of seeing the world without us realizing it, like what it's doing inside of us and giving us ideas about things that may or may not be accurate, but which somehow call us. I don't know if I can articulate it any more than that. I mean, I think I grew up in a family, my father was very prominent in the church, and he had a real belief in the application of spirituality to relieving the suffering of others. I mean, he was a primary school headmaster in a very rough area of Glasgow, and he established things like chess clubs and a prefect system and a soccer club because he really wanted to show those children that there was more to education than reading and writing, that you could grow in all sorts of ways within a school community, even when there were enormous pressures of poverty and disenfranchisement and substance abuse in the community. There were still ways that education could offer you something. You might not be the brightest kid at school, but you might be captain of the soccer team, for example. It was fascinating, if I can just digress. I only heard this story the other day from my brother, that he set up the chess club, which is not a standard hobby in the poverty-stricken areas of Glasgow. And the kids did really well with it. And he got them to play. He started his career in the private school system. And he set up a tournament, and his chess club played the top players in this private school he'd previously been worked in. And the kids in his school completely wiped the board, excuse the pun, with these kids. And when he was reflecting on it with my brother afterwards, he said, these children have such difficult lives. They're used to being three steps ahead all the time in order to keep themselves safe. And they are using that in their chess moves. And that's why they won. And that was just such an interesting insight, I think, and such a good way to harness the difficulties they were facing to make that work for them and give them a sense of purpose and esteem and capacity and maybe some skills for later life. I'm not sure. But yeah, he was. So that was just very much in our family growing up, that you used your knowledge to try and do things in the world, teaching, medicine, whatever it might be. Yeah.
It seems like you've articulated it very well. There's a through line from that to where you went and where you are now, the theme of an intellectual challenge and actually facing difficulties. The intellectual challenges themselves can be difficulties, and the application of what one learns toward difficulties. There is a theme that you've discussed of connection, the importance of connection, and it, among the many things that your father created was places where the children could connect in ways that really helped them with their social emotional learning, as you said, not just the book learning. And then there was this recognition of the suffering that was very present and impossible not to see. And it's kind of, you know, it's what you began to see when you started encountering the world of mental health and seeing how fascinating and curious and how all these things could be applied there. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much. If you could take us, we're going to kind of wind around in a little different way because of what I know about your background, how I know you, but our connection, the intersection of the two of us is through the world of mindfulness. So maybe talk to us a little bit about how that became part of your healership, we could say, and how you got involved in teaching, teacher training, involved in groups that are setting standards for teacher training and really devoting a big part of your life. What is it that you saw for people in general? And maybe we can you can also begin to weave it back into for your colleagues, because I know a big part of your healership has been bringing that work to your colleagues.
So that's such a big topic. And I think that where it started, really, if I maybe just go through it chronologically, because that's how it unfolded, that when I did psychiatry training, I was fortunate enough to encounter more people who were pushing the barriers of psychiatric interventions in the world. And one of them was Jan Scott, who went over to the US and trained with Tim Beck in CBT right in the early days, cognitive behavior therapy. So while I was a psychiatrist and training and all this sort of neurobiological elements of psychiatry and the prescribing and the management planning and the social interventions, the psychological piece had been very much and was very much dominated and to some extent still is dominated by the psychodynamic, psychoanalytic movement. And here was this, which didn't really call to me particularly as a practical way of helping people who were suffering. And I always felt there was an element of victim blaming in that. That might be a little bit controversial to say, but the sense that, you know, that you just interpret the defenses and people would somehow gain insight and recover didn't really fit with my lived experience of what was happening with my patients. And then I was introduced to cognitive behavior therapy, and it was such a practical, clear model. It was about, you know, you've got this problem, but this is what it's about. This is what thinking and behavior can contribute to that. This is within your control. You can change these things, see what happens. And then when I started using it with my patients and people got better, it was like, oh, right, okay, this stuff really works. This is great. Then I came out to Australia and continued with that mix of general adult psychiatry and cognitive behavior therapy for depression and anxiety. And what I noticed was you could give somebody a course of antidepressants, you could give somebody a course of CBT or both together, and they would recover. But if you're in private practice or any kind of practice long enough, clinical practice generally, when people come back to you, you can see that beyond the research studies, which might have a follow-up period of a couple of years, 3 years maybe at the most, in most cases, but you're seeing people over 5, 10, 20 years, you know, you get to know your patients over a long period of time. And people were relapsing again, despite having had these evidence-based interventions. And so it was quite a demoralizing period for myself and for them. Like, what next? What do we do next? Change the antidepressant, change, do another course of CBT right from the beginning, which had an element of being there, done that for both myself and the patient. And it can be hard to inject optimism for change in that setting. And it was very fortuitous that on the 15th of March 2002, a day in my life I will never forget, Professor Mark Williams came out to Australia on a study tour and ran a half-day workshop called New Directions in CBT. Didn't even mention the word mindfulness, just said New Directions in CBT. And he spent the first half of the workshop talking about the theory and the hypotheses about why people relapse in depression in particular. And then he talked about Jon Kabat-Zinn's work in MBSR and how they had spent time with him and how they'd modified it and applied it to recurrent depression, because the theoretical hypotheses as to why people would have recurrent depression lend themselves beautifully to mindfulness practice, stepping out of thinking, coming back into the present moment, bringing a non-judgmental, accepting, kind attitude to oneself and one's suffering, the realization that we can free ourselves from suffering by where we place our attention and that we have some control over that. And they had by then run a couple of randomized control trials that showed it was effective. And then after a beautiful presentation of the theory, he led us in some practices, which were, I mean, I think I had a couple of epiphanies in that workshop. It was quite an extraordinary day, which is why it's etched in my mind forever. Because one thing was that I noticed I had some pain in my neck and shoulders, tension, tightness during the practice. And as you know, you watch the breath and you watch things unfold moment by moment. After a while, I realized the pain had gone. And there's something about pain being there and pain going within a practice of paying attention that was really quite extraordinary. Because I think we have an assumption if we've got pain or depression is coming back, it's going to continue. And this was a fear that my patients had. I've got some early warning signs of depression. It's going to continue. I'm going to go down the black hole again. I'm going to be there for days or weeks or months. I'm going to be back in hospital. My job, my family life is going to be disrupted. And yet that notion of impermanence just showed up right away, and things don't always go the way you expect them to. So that was very powerful. And then he read the Guesthouse poem, which is the same thing, you know, but also not just that these emotional guests come and go within our guesthouse of experience, but also that we can have this attitude of meet them at the door laughing, welcome, bring them in, entertain them for a while, let them pass out the door again. There was something about that whole attitude to our experience of suffering that all human beings have that was just so different to what anything I'd ever been taught before. And, you know, endemic in medicine is this idea that the doctor diagnoses and takes ownership and responsibility of fixing the problem for the patient, to the patient. And while CBT was much more collaborative, you could work on things together, the simplicity of just coming to the breath, there's nothing difficult about that. It's not a difficult strategy to learn, if you want to put it that way. CBT, you know, for all it's quite straightforward, is actually for some people quite mysterious and hard to remember. Whereas just sitting down and focusing on your breath every day for a period of time, it's accessible, it's manageable with guidance and support, and you can pick it up and do it anytime. So what I then did was apply that to my practice and found that when I started running 8-week mindfulness-based cognitive therapy courses, that people who had been relapsing stopped relapsing as much. They might still relapse, but they weren't as frightened by it. It didn't last as long. Their medication dosages could come down sometimes. It just was such a useful, pragmatic application, once again, of an intellectual but also experiential understanding and applying it to human suffering in a specific way that would make a difference. So I really loved that period of my life. And then, of course, my colleagues were hearing about these courses, and they said, oh, can we come and sit in? And then people were saying, oh, can you just run one for us? Don't have depression. So modified the same principles for stress and stress in healthcare in particular. And then to fast track the whole thing, I realized very quickly that particularly the junior staff and the interns were falling asleep within 2 minutes of lying down on the floor to do a body scan because they were exhausted, and that the course had to be briefer, the meditations had to be shorter, and they were either done sitting or standing, stretching and moving, because I was very, you know, influenced by Amishi Jha's research that showed just 12 minutes could make a difference. So I made the meditations 15 minutes in duration because that seemed much more accessible. And of course, the inevitable happens. I don't have 15 minutes in my day. 15 minutes is far too long. I'm bored after 2 minutes. And it's like, yeah, well, my patients are doing 40 minutes a day back in the clinic. So come on, guys, you can do this. And it took off. This course, the 6-week mindful self-care course, has taken off in ways I had never imagined. It went over to Taiwan and Hong Kong and China. I've got a whole lot of colleagues in the UK and a bunch of NHS trusts who have been running the courses there after I did some training supervision with them. And of course, we continue to run them here, and they've been picked up interstate around Australia and in New Zealand as well. So I guess things that work endure and things that don't pass out of our repertoire. So with very little promoting or prompting, because I'm so stretched and busy, it continues. And it is a joy for me to teach and to supervise others in this course, because the practice of mindfulness just brings us back to the immediacy of the present moment, the capacity to check in with ourselves, see how we're going, stopping the judging and the self-criticism. I've also been very influenced by Paul Gilbert's work and Kristen Neff and Chris Germer's work in self-compassion, have woven this into the 6-week course more, emphasize more the self-compassion piece, because we know from the research that physicians especially are exceptionally good at self-criticism. And indeed, the hidden curriculum of medicine is been about doing well by beating ourselves up and using self-criticism as a motivator to higher performance, which can be a short-term, fairly effective strategy, but a long-term career killer, as we know. So I've gone down the path of how I've applied mindfulness in healthcare settings. Of course, before that and alongside of that, I started getting involved in training and supervision in the 8-week mindfulness courses, and co-founded a teacher training institute in Australia and New Zealand with my colleague and friend Tim Goddard, whom we both know, and with other wonderful faculty. And they have continued to run those trainings to this day. I've had to step out because I needed to focus on the staff wellbeing projects, but that institute continues, which is wonderful. And yes, briefly, as you mentioned, for a year or two, I chaired the International Committee on Integrity for Mindfulness Teacher Training, which, of course, over many countries with their different legal jurisdictions and obligations and insurance policies, was quite a complicated project. So, yeah, it's been an interesting career path, I must say.
Yes. You know, it's so wonderful to hear you talk about this, because a lot of the experience that you share, I've had the very similar experience in the very similar time frame, although not in mental health, but in the early 2000s, beginning to teach this, and then how physicians would self-direct themselves to the course and find themselves, and then asking the question, this would be really, really wonderful to do as a collective, a community of health professionals. And that's kind of how I moved into it. It was out of suggestions of people who were participating. So that's really, really quite interesting. So I'd like to just shift a little bit. Maybe you can give us now that you talked about this and how you got involved in colleagues and their health and well-being through the mindfulness teaching and program that you created and that is now spread. But Now, I'd like to understand a little bit of the landscape of physician and other health professionals and their well-being or lack thereof, or the challenges too, in South Australia, maybe in all of Australia, because you're probably familiar. It's not a huge population country, so you're probably in touch with what's going on beyond just the South Australia region, and how you then were called to serve in leadership in the South Australian health region as director of staff well-being. How'd that happen, and what led to that?
Yes, it really grew out of the mindfulness work. Mick, it really, when you're teaching mindfulness to healthcare staff and talking about how to apply it to the problems and pressures, challenges that we face in healthcare, you know, I'd hear the stories about what was happening in the different settings from the different organizations that these healthcare professionals were coming from. And I could see that mindfulness helps us cope with a very difficult problem. 21st century healthcare is a wicked problem, using that definition of a complex problem that doesn't have any straightforward answers and probably never does have answers. An ongoing interaction with the difficulties that arise, that mindfulness is certainly an important piece, but it became clearer to me as I went on that if that's all you offer people, it's victim blaming, it's tokenistic, it assumes that the problem is lying with the individual and not with the system or the organization. And then somebody sent me an expression of interest to a wellbeing committee that was being formed in our network, which is the largest network in South Australia. There's about 18,000 employees. And so I joined that committee, and after too long a while, started chairing that committee. We work very closely with the workforce teams, HR, work health safety, organizational development staff who were involved in this committee. We had an executive sponsor who was the executive director of people and culture or workforce. And we had a co-chair who was executive director of medical services. So the organization was taking the committee seriously. And as we started to examine the literature and at the same time help with a big whole of public sector survey, and we saw the results, it was also happening during COVID. So there's a whole lot of things we were doing to help staff manage the pressures and pain of COVID, that we realized that there was this amazing literature from Stanford and the Mayo Clinic on staff well-being that was really sophisticated. And again, I guess it goes back to that thing about being called to the intellectual, when there's a persuasive intellectual argument and a body of research, you can really use that to inform your work. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. You can just quickly go to work that other fantastic people have done and apply it to your setting. And when we had the results of our survey, which showed that 60 to 65% of our staff, not surprisingly, were either burnt out or showing signs of burnout. Quite aside from that, 70% were scoring as highly resilient on the resilience scale. This is not a failing of personal capacity. Healthcare staff are resilient by definition, and the research shows that. But they were certainly under huge amounts of pressure with long working hours and other conditions that make it difficult for even the most resilient person in the world to do their job for a long period of time. So those results were very concerning, but also very helpful, because it gave us the evidence we needed that things had to be done. We argued for the creation of a position of chief wellness officer, which in our organization they decided to make as a director, call it director of staff wellbeing. And in other settings, as you probably know, chief wellness officers have been just for physicians only. But in our organization, it was decided to make it for the whole of the organization, which I actually agree with, because we don't work in disciplinary silos. We work in multidisciplinary specialties. We work in teams. We work with other people. We work with nurses. We work with allied health. And in those teams, that is your lived experience. That's your daily experience of a professional life, is interacting with patients, their families, nurses, allied health staff, and your medical colleagues. So, and the work from Stanford is very clear that the interventions that you do have to be bespoke for that particular unit or department. The pressures that staff suffer are not all the same. I mean, they can be largely grouped under culture, team culture, and if things that get in the way of efficiency of practice, that's the Stanford model. And then the personal resilience piece is in there too. Obviously, we try and bring our best selves to work. That's a professional obligation to some extent. But if those other pieces aren't in place, then it doesn't matter how professional and resilient you are, you won't be able to be effective. So that meant having to rethink our approach. When the position was created and it was offered to me as an interim position and then became a substantive position, and about 18 months or so into this job now, I again went to the literature to look at, well, what can we do? This is not about rolling out mindfulness programs across the organization. Much as I believe in it and personally benefit from it, this is not the treatment of choice here. We have to go in to the teams that we find are struggling and diagnose what's going on and what needs to be done to help them, and how we can help them, and how we can teach them how to help themselves with things that are within their sphere of control. And what we find is that, I'm sure this is true everywhere, but social medicine is very high in the political agenda here. That attracts a lot of media coverage, often adverse media coverage, which is really another very good way to burn out hardworking staff, is to continually see their hospital or their team being reported on in a fairly catastrophic manner in the press on a regular basis. But there is a real social justice element in Australian healthcare. So much of it is available to everyone in the population through our Medicare system, and that is provided by people who are dedicated to working in the public hospitals where all the teaching, training, and research happens. How do we keep good staff in there to provide that excellent level of healthcare to people who have no other means of accessing it? It's a political hot potato. It's a social justice thing for the people who remain in healthcare. And it's very fraught emotionally because for all of those reasons. And it has definitely, going to executives, the department, various high-level meetings to present a practical model that says, if we do this, if we do that, if we embed wellbeing leads in each of the departments or teams or clinical streams, we can apply world's best practice, measure, evaluate, fine-tune, redirect, put in the ingredients that that team, that department need. Then you will keep people engaged. You will give them a sense of hope that things can be done, and move people out of the learned helplessness that has arisen when it feels like healthcare has been outsourced to the health minister or bureaucrats, as people call them, or administration or executive. And it has really developed a them and us narrative, which is not helping. There's a divide that stops people getting together around the table, putting their wonderful minds and warm hearts to this wicked problem of how we deliver excellent healthcare to everyone, but particularly those who can't afford it in any other way. And I feel sometimes like I'm a connector between the two sides of the organization. I feel squeezed very thin by both sides. I'm using my hands, which of course the audience can't see, to just demonstrate how squeezed I feel at times, or how stretched I feel at times trying to bring the two sides together. There's this kind of extraordinary void that things fall into bureaucratically, never to be seen again. That you think, where did that piece of paper go? Where did that application go? Where did that brief go? Like, there's all sorts of things you start to encounter in this job that you don't encounter as a clinician working on the floor. It's been a very steep learning curve. It's been the hardest job I've ever done since I was an intern, that's for sure. And as one of my lovely colleagues interstate said, who's the first chief wellness officer in Australia and a great mentor to us, Bethan Richards, she said, this job, either people love you or they hate you. You have good days or you have great days or you have bad days. You never seem to have very much in between. That's the experience of the job. And oh my goodness, do you need a mindfulness practice to manage all of that?
Very well said. Yeah. I'm really curious as what you've learned that has surprised you thus far into this job. In particular, what has surprised you about leaders that you had maybe other thoughts and ideas about already formed? So in some ways, your biases. And what surprised you about your staff that you may have also had similar or different kinds of ideas about and how, what are some of the those great parts that really has have been a nice surprise for you?
Well, there've been many. I mean, it's been such a blessed and privileged position to be in. Doing the Chief Wellness Officer course at Stanford last year was so very, very helpful. And Tate Schoenfeld and his faculty are just standout human beings, huge hearts, as well as huge intellects and research capacities. But Tate would say to us over and over again, there are no villains. There are no villains in your organization. There are no villains. I've got that on a sticky note above my desk to remind me that when people do things that I don't like, they probably have a very good reason in their mind as to why they're doing it. And I genuinely try and believe everyone is doing their best. I don't think there are many psychopaths in this organization. I think most people are really trying to do their best. They've got a very clear rationale why they're doing it, and it doesn't always line up with how I see things. And trying to step away from conflict and to understand what might be going on and the various pressures that people are under, and trying to convey that to the staff who've become very distrustful of admin or exec or management, or they're generally just lumped into a one-size-fits-all category of people that are getting in the way of good medicine. Whereas, you know, on the other side, I'm working with them closely, seeing how hard they're working to try and make the system work. And it's a complex, enormously complex problem, an aging population and lower tax contributions, because younger people, there's less younger people in comparison to the number of older people that need care and healthcare in particular. So that's really important. There are no villains. People are trying to do their best. Really important to remember that and try and keep good relationships with everyone. I'm not going to say that's easy. It's a huge struggle at times, but I think if we all come to the workplace every day with that notion in mind, then we'll get past pointless wars and conflicts that just waste everybody's time and energies. The other thing that continually amazes me about my clinical colleagues, and I'm really struck by that with the staff who are staying in Gaza to man those hospitals and to continue to provide healthcare under just the most awful, awful circumstances. To a much lesser extent, we have that here in our emergency departments and intensive care units all around the system. In fact, people are doing extraordinary work. They're just coming in every day and getting on with it and doing really good clinical work. And you encounter the most amazing leaders in the most unlikely places. It might be a fairly junior nurse who's got a passion for the well-being of her team, who will set up barbecues and social events. And we have a big peer support program. That's one of the planks of our intervention, is to get a peer support program across the different teams. I mean, I could talk about all the different things we're actually doing to try and fix things, but one of them is peer support, because we know that sense of connection and camaraderie is incredibly powerful. It's always been part of medicine. I really noticed that when I became an intern and felt part of a team, that it was a difficult year, an exhausting year. But we had so much sense of connection and laughter and being looked after by your seniors, that it, and the senior nurses in particular, that kind of got you through that whole fairly mad experience and allowed you to do good work. And incredibly difficult to put a price on camaraderie, incredibly important thing to foster and cultivate, because it's priceless. It's absolutely priceless. When you harness the collective energies of people, some people just rise to the occasion and are extraordinary leaders who believe in peace rather than war, and with their colleagues who are really trying to stop narratives of them and us or divide and try and connect with the intern on the other end of the phone in another ward that you're trying to persuade to take patient out of the emergency department into an overburdened gen medical bed. And why fight? Why not connect? Say, you must be having a horrendous day as well. It's really busy. You know, we're really overloaded, but we need to transfer this patient. And it's all about connection and communication and trying to be present to the difficulties. Very, very hard to do that in a really stressed situation. And I'm always reassured when I remember John Kabat-Zinn saying once that mindful speech was the most difficult and the most advanced practice of all.
Thank you. You know, You've kind of summarized it in this peer support. And actually, that's been a through line through so many of the interviews that I've had with people, is that that is something that a leader and a looking at the system can look at and say, how do we create an environment where people support each other, both formally, which is important, and also informally. And then on an individual level, each one of us can go come to work and say, how can I not only take care of myself, but how can I help take care of the person next to me, the person on my team? So that's lovely. The other thing I wanted to say, you know, this, there are no villains that Tate Shanafelt shared with you, and that's now kind of a mantra for you. And by the way, we've had Colin on the show, who did a lot of work in the early days with Tate at the Mayo. And a lot of the things that you are saying really dovetails nicely with what he said. I remember you mentioned Jon Kabat-Zinn. One of my early trainings with Jon Kabat-Zinn, him saying the following, he said, you know, the people that you bump up against and that you may not really quite understand where they're coming from, and I pardon my French, they're not assholes. They know what they know, and they're trying to do their best, really. And that's something that's always kept with, that stayed with me, that really, when I would meet adversity, I would think to myself, yeah, well, this person doesn't get up in the morning thinking how to make Mick Krasner's life miserable. No, not at all. They're trying to kind of get through their day and do what they can do. So thank you for mentioning that. And I think that's a wonderful little mantra or sticky note to put on us. There are no villains. We're going to be coming to a close. You've been so generous with your time, but I wanted to read something to you. It's the first time I've kind of done this in these podcasts, although other people have shared something spontaneously, but I actually have been thinking about joy in medicine, that, you know, deep kind of eudaimonic satisfaction that our teams get when the work is well done, maybe on the days that you come in and say, it's been a great day. And when a system can look, a team can look at the work they've been doing for the last several months and say, wow, there's joy in that. And I heard this from Jack Kornfield, you know, a teacher that we both know and love. And it's not his writing, but it's a poem, and I'll read it to you. And then I want to ask you a response to this. So it's called A Brief for the Defense by Jack Gilbert. You may have heard it before, but I'll read it, and mostly for our listeners. Sorrow everywhere. Slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they're starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they've known and the awfulness in their future, smiling and laughing, while somebody in the village is very sick. There's laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages of Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit there will be music despite everything. We stand at the prow again of a small ship anchored late at night in the tiny port, looking over to the sleeping island. The waterfront is three shuttered cafes and one naked light burning. To hear the faint sound of oars in the silence as a rowboat comes slowly out and then goes back is truly worth all the years of sorrow that are to come. So you just feel into that. Maybe you can share what you understand about the personal joy that has been yours, hopefully, in your professional and personal life.
Oh, I love that. I love that, Mick. That was extraordinary. And you read it so beautifully as well. One of the images that just stands out from what you just read were the women laughing together while somebody in the village is dying, and that camaraderie as they, you know, collect water or cook communally or whatever it is, that capacity we have to connect and laugh even in the face of or while other awful things are going on around us is just such an extraordinary capacity that we have as human beings. And I think that one of the problems I encounter in the staff wellbeing work in particular is that people often feel I can't be happy until this wicked problem of healthcare is solved, or until I've paid off the mortgage, or until my kids have left home, or until I go on holiday. And one of the practices we teach comes from the MBCT course, the Pleasant Event Calendar. You know, I call it lifting our gaze. You know, yes, everything's really difficult. You've had an awful clinic, somebody you care about has, your patient books has died or relapsed or whatever, but you can still open up to the beautiful things that the world offers us, either the connection with other human beings, the shared laughter, the sunset, the sunrise, all of the things that nature really offers us as a way of coming back to, you know, we're a little tiny creature on this earth and we need to remember that. And it's not perfect and it's not permanent. And we have to somehow pan out, you know, to that stance, I think, that attitude to life, that I think we can have this sense of privilege that we should have, everything should be a certain way. And the thing about medicine is it holds out such promise now that we've almost come to expect that we won't suffer and that we'll be incredibly healthy until we die peacefully in our sleep around 98 years of age, having been able to do everything we wanted to up until that point, which is just, I think it's a myth that's around in the ether because of how advanced medicine is, but it's inaccurate. You know, life is inherently full of suffering. You know, the noble truth, number one, there is suffering. We have to acknowledge that and be with that and take the joy where we can. And I just want to add one more thing here, which my wonderful colleague, Paul Bernard in the NHS, who's a mindfulness teacher there, talks about the privilege of being in medicine, the privilege of being with people at those moments of suffering, the privilege of having learned things that we can use to help people, those incredible moments that we share with people and their families. There is a great privilege in medicine as well as exposure to suffering. And it's important that we place our attention on that sometimes and, you know, lift our attention out of everything that's wrong with healthcare. And actually, there's more right with it than wrong with it in first world countries. You know, I say that to my trainees all the time. We'll see a headline, you know, hospital in crisis. No, our hospitals are not in crisis. The hospitals in Gaza are in crisis. We have struggles and difficulties. Language matters. We have to watch the words we use. They influence how we feel and how we behave and how we react. So that poem somehow brings all of that together so well. Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful way to conclude what's been a delightful conversation, Maura, and I'm just really, really thankful for your generosity of your time, and we'll end here. Thank you very much for listening. We will include a summary of today's podcast and links about Dr. Kenny and other references that were discussed in the show notes. I would like to conclude by sharing another practical exercise to help you flourish. During this podcast, Dr. Kenny mentioned a poem that was written by Rumi, the 12th century Sufi mystic from what is now Afghanistan. Reference to this poem can be found in the show notes, but I'd like to read it to you. And you can listen to this from time to time as you see fit, as an invitation to welcome both the difficult and the easy, both the bad and the good, both the comfortable and the uncomfortable, perhaps cultivating a sense of potential for all of our lived moments and realizing that our life unfolds truly in the only moments that we actually have, which are right now. The Guest House by Jalaluddin Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. I do hope you found this podcast and the simple exercise, this listening exercise, useful to you, and look forward to having you join us for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. If you'd like to learn more about MPRO and its peer support programs, please visit www.mympro.com/peer-support. I'd like to thank Jerry Donahue, Vice President of Education at MPRO, for producing this podcast, and Stan Sanjour for his technical expertise in recording and editing. If you are a physician or medical student and in need of urgent support, please consider calling the Physician Support Line at 1-888-409-0141 or visiting www.physiciansupportline.com. The Physician Support Line provides a safe place to discuss immediate life stressors with volunteer psychiatrist colleagues who are uniquely trained in mental wellness and have similar shared experiences of the profession of medicine. For more information about me and my work, please visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Until next time.